Thank you very much. And I want to thank the organizers, in particular Shiv, for putting together a really jam-packed day, and it looks like we're going to have some an exciting day. And I'm actually awed and honored to be the first speaker, although I don't know much about modeling. But I hope to set the stage, because I think one of the important points that we need to think about when we go into talking about modeling is really what can go into those models. I put pressure in parentheses because I realized putting together the talk that I've got plenty to talk about. Just talking about flow. And also, so I know I'm on the agenda. I'm sure he's going to tell you all about how to measure pressure. So, okay, well, related. So just to start with a very what I would call black box blocks approach that I take to any mathematical model. When we talk about any model of intracranial dynamics, what we really have to think about is the inputs, the things that are going into that model, whatever this model might be, the outputs, what's coming out of that model, and then that we're going to have some test points here and there where we can actually probe the model and look at what's going on. And the question that I want to approach this morning is, what are those test points? What are those inputs and outputs that we might have access to that could go into any particular model that we might be talking about? So in terms of flow, of course, you know, there are two components. Bulk flow, which people have been focusing on for many years, of course, is with respect to CSF, is responsible or is driven by the production absorption of CSF. And of course, with respect to blood, there's just cerebral blood flow perfusing the brain. Of course, this is modulated for the most part by resistance to flow. For example, in the case of a stenosis, you might have some changes in that bulk flow. On the other hand, what we've been focusing on for many years is the measurement, the understanding of the effects of pulsatile flow. For example, we know that there are pulsations of CSF through the aqueduct. Of course, there are pulsations of the arteries, which are actually causing those pulsations. And for the most part, with respect to the physics, it's modulated by not the resistance to flow, but what we call the impedance to flow, the compliance of the vessels, or the compliance of the system. Of course, one small point that I just want to point out is this is all what I would call dynamics of the system. One other thing that can go into these models is really the statics of the system, and that is the spatial distributions of the various components that are making up the brain, distributions of CSF, for example. So one of the things that we have to think about is that the cranium, because it's a closed system, is really is very complex but also a coherent system. We've got some sort of input into the system, arterial input, which is infusing both bulk blood flow into the brain as well as pulsation into the brain, which has to be dissipated in some way, and it's dissipated in the form of the release of venous blood out of the brain, but also in the formation and absorption of CSF as well as the pulsation of CSF within the brain. Now, this is going to be a really complicated slide, and I don't have much time, so I'm going to try to go through it quickly. But when we think about these components, there's a lot of stuff that we know, and there's a lot of stuff that we don't know. So I just wanted to take a look very quickly what's there. So in terms of arterial flow, we can look at both the bulk flow. We know that the purpose of bulk flow there is cerebral perfusion. The blood, of course, is coming from the heart. We know certain things that happen and how this is modulated in terms of things that can happen and go wrong in the brain. In terms of pulsatile flow, the purpose is actually unknown. Why is the pulsatile flow into the brain? Why is the flow into the brain pulsatile? Simply because it comes from the heart. That's kind of a naive way to look at it. And it has been documented that pulsations increase with age, for example. They're diminished. There have been documented diminished pulsations in, for example, NPH. Some documentation that in things like vascular dementia, for example. And like I said before, modulated for the most part by the compliance of the vessels. This drives CSF bulk flow. The purpose is, for the most part, to supply nutrients, to dispose of the neurotoxins from the brain. We know that the turnover to CSF decreases with age, modulated for the most part by outflow resistance to CSF. Now, on the other side of the equation is pulsatile CSF flow, which is the purpose seems to be the dissipation of arterial pulsations, allowing venting of CSF at the craniocervical junction. Not sure what happens with age, for example. We know there are increased aqueductal pulsations in NPH. I don't know that anyone's documented carefully in pediatric hydrocephalus and other types of hydrocephalus. And again, it's modulated by intracranial compliance. Now, of course, bulk arterial flow drives bulk venous flow, which for the most part mirrors arterial bulk flow, although there are local differences depending on the venous system. On the pulsatile flow of the equation, this also serves to dissipate arterial pulsations, and there's possibly, Bateman's actually done a number of interesting studies looking at changes in venous pulsatility and NPH. Okay, one of the things that we're interested in from a modeling perspective is there a connection? We've kind of looked at these as very separate systems, very separate effects. Is there a connection between changes in bulk flow and changes in pulsatile flow? And I think that's a very important thing to think about when we talk about modeling. One example is the Windkessel effect. We know if we look, and this is just copied, I apologize to the author for not putting, but this is a kind of a standard picture that you see in texts. We know that the arterial pulsations systemically, for the most part, are damped as you go into the capillaries, into the venous system. In the brain, on the other hand, it's one of the only places that we have venous pulsations. And one of the questions that we can ask, where does this come from? Is it coupling directly from the arteries? Is it coupling through the CSF? What are the purpose of those venous pulsations in the brain? The take-home point from all of this is that we have a very complicated system interacting components of arterial venous CSF flow in terms of both bulk and pulsatile flow. One of the things we have to think about is not always a question of how much flow, but how is that flow distributed throughout the cranium. Okay, I'm going to talk about how to measure flow. So this is a mathematical institute. I guess I can talk a little bit about physics. How do we measure flow? Hopefully some of you have seen a pulse sequence diagram. This is a pulse sequence diagram for what we call phase contrast imaging. And it's exactly the same as any other old imaging sequence, except for this pair of gradient pulses. So it's just a gradient magnetic field that we apply. It's a bipolar field. So we apply it in one direction and then in the other direction. If we look very carefully at that bipolar gradient, what happens is that during the first part of that, the spins actually dephase. They actually change their direction, okay, depending on where they're sitting. Okay, depending on where they're sitting, they change direction. During the other half, they go back exactly the same amount. So in the end, we have no net change in the direction of the spins. On the other hand, if we let the spins move, okay, so if the spins are moving during this time, they change direction the same amount, let's say, during this half, but they're going to change a different amount because they're going to be in a different position during the second half. This is a naive approach, but you get the idea. Obviously, they're moving during the entire period. The point is that the phase of the direction of the spins is directly proportional to velocity, how fast they are moving, and that's why it's called phase contrast MRI. Now, what can we measure using this technique? I just want to, this is kind of the upshot of what I think we can look at and things that are important. From the vascular standpoint, we can look at the cervical level. I know I'm spending a lot of work in that. In that respect, we're looking at net vascular flow, both arterial and venous, in the extracranial carotids, the vertebrals, and the jugulars. Intracranially, we can also look at the vascular flow. It's interesting because we can look at, for example, the supracontorial portion of that flow, but in the carotids, the basilar, and in various sinuses. There's also been some interesting reports. I'm sure some of you have seen Bateman's results looking at cortical venous pulsatility, which we can also look at. Typically, we look at that, the bridging veins coming, draining into the sagittal sinus, for example. In terms of CSF pulsatility, or bulk flow for that matter, a lot of people focus on the aqueduct. It's an important component because it supplies or vents pulsatility from the ventricles. We can also look in the prepontine cistern. We feel that's important because that's looking specifically at the supratentorial component of the pulsatility. A lot of people have started within the last few years to look at pulsatility at the craniocervical junction, which is basically the net pulsatility or the net flow of CSF in the system. Of course, we can look in other places like the third ventricle, the convexities, et cetera, although the convexities are extremely difficult. I'm just going to run through this very quickly. This is kind of what a typical CSF flow study would look like. It doesn't really look like an image, but you're seeing here velocities. So you're seeing, let's say, positive velocities at the craniocervical junction or out of the aqueduct. One of the things that we've worked on over the last couple of years is improving the flow imaging techniques. One of the problems that we found that people know about is that the typical what's called phase contrast imaging is extremely inefficient technique for measuring CSF because CSF has a very long relaxation time. It takes a long time to come back in order to get tempo resolution over the cardiac cycle because we're interested in looking at pulsatility over the cardiac cycle. You don't really give that CSF enough time to go back. You have very poor signal quality. So we've been working on another technique called SSFP, steady state free possession, which actually gives you much better results in terms of signal intensity. This is a graph of signal intensity for those two techniques as a function of what's called flip angle, and you can see that because the CSF has a very long relaxation time, the optimum is actually comes out very low, whereas here you can get almost all the signal possible. A big difference here between the amount of signal we can get, and one of the things we found is we can get, yeah?
Can you go back? Right?
Yeah, as long as I get extra time.
It's very interesting. Are you taking into account the inflow effect?
No. Okay, yeah. Yeah, the inflow effect will bring this up a little bit. So it's a little unfair. The inflow effect, depending on where you're...
If you didn't take it into account?
Sorry? Well, I know how much the inflow effect is, so I can model that. It brings about by about a factor of two. So whereas the optimal angle is about 5 degrees here, it's typically about 10 degrees for CSF. So it's at around 0.1. That's a good point. So what we've done with this is we've looked at both imaging at the craniocervical junction and in the prepontine cistern. These are two, they're related, but we think very important CSF flow pathways. And what we found is that we get much improved both signal-to-noise and coverage of, in particular, the prepontine cistern, we think, because it's a very complex space that CSF is flowing through. So we get what we think is improved quantitation in these areas, as well as marked dramatic improvements that you saw from that graph in terms of signal to noise in all of these imaging techniques. So what we get is, with these techniques, improved quantitation, improved signal to noise, hopefully can move to faster measurements, the ability to measure more planes. These are single slice techniques, so you can typically only measure a single region. Going back to the comment that I made before, we can also use this very same technique to make very high resolution structural images of the CSF spaces. If you're interested in knowing what the CSF subarachnoid space looks like in very high detail, we can do these types of images in under 4 minutes with almost a half a millimeter resolution, and also very nice contrast between the CSF and the in the background tissue. We can use this to do very accurate volumetrics of not only ventricles, which is usually not all difficult, but also the subarachnoid spaces. Just a couple of pitfalls, and I just put together a couple to think about. One that actually I just saw in a conference proceeding just a couple of months ago that I found fascinating, and this was looking at respiratory effects of CSF flow at the craniocervical junction. So they looked at various points in the respiratory cycle, and you can see that there's marked changes in the stroke volume, marked changes in the amount of CSF that's pulsating. Now, you got to take this with a bit of grain of salt, because this is measured, each one of these is measured at a particular point. So you see very marked, probably almost 20-30% changes in stroke volume, the amount of CSF that's pulsating. On the other hand, these are taken at very particular, only during, let's say, inspiration and only during expiration. When we do a typical MRI experiment, we're measuring throughout the respiratory cycle and kind of averaging. We did some quick experiments at Stony Brook. We see a little bit of changes. So here, we're doing experiments where we're starting the experiment kind of randomly. Here we're starting in the valley of the respiratory cycle, and here we're starting at the peak of the respiratory cycle. You see, in this case, you only get about up to about 10% or so variation, depending on when you're measuring. We're still not sure what exactly the best technique is. Again, something I think we need to think about, what are the respiratory effects on all these measurements? And it's important, because if we want to talk about quantitation, we want to get things right. Just quick points about quantitation. There's actually a chart from a letter to the editor on an article that we published about a year ago in the Journal of Neurosurgery. And the letter pointed out the fact that we can calculate the venous compression based on measurements of arterial stroke volume and measurements, in other words, what's the input to the system, and measurements of CSF stroke volume, what's the CSF output, so presumably the venous output is what's left over. Unfortunately, if you look at these, all these measurements are made, all these measurements were made just below the circle of Willis. So this is the pulsatility going into the supratentorial brain. And all these measurements were made at the CSF, the craniocervical junction. So it's net CSF flow. We're not measuring the same thing. So you have to be careful when you're doing these. If you want to do absolute quantitation, are we comparing apples with apples? Sure. The arterial stroke volume here is measured just below the circle of Willis. So that's the blood flow going into the supratentorial brain. You're not looking at the blood flow, for example, that's feeding the cerebellum infratentorially. Okay, there's pulsation and as well as bulk flow that's feeding that portion of the brain. These measurements were not measured at the vertebral level. You're correct. If you were to measure the vertebral level, my point is you just have to be careful what are the measurements I'm looking at. Thank you for pointing that out. And in terms of absolute quantitation, if you look at...
When you're talking about venous compression,
yeah.
Veins are not just veins. What veins are you talking about?
In this case, because I'm looking at kind of the system as a black box, there's an input and there are outputs. So you're talking about anything within the intracranial cavity. Anything that's compressed, anything that's accommodating for the pulsatility that's coming into the brain.
You're excluding in the
No. I would not be. Why would you think I would be excluding those?
Because they're totally...
Well, there's no compression.
Well, there is compression, but it's a very much less degree.
Yeah. This is a global...
...has to be the same as the pressure in the cortical subarachnoid space, because it's such a small, a thin wall vessel. There's no... You cannot have a pressure differential...
Okay.
In the vein to the cortical subarachnoid space. So that there can't be
a static pressure difference. I would argue that you could have a dynamic pressure difference over the cardiac cycle, over particular portions of the cardiac cycle, which is what you're looking at here. You're really looking at pulsations.
Yeah. But they must be completely linked. Because it's a
free-floating,
thin-walled thing within this fluid
component.
Yeah. So it can't have a life of its own.
That's true. Yeah.
Just for the sake of completeness,
mm-hmm.
in 1996, we published a value that is very similar to your
value. Yeah.
If you want to check out for fitness.
Yeah, okay.
1996 altering the number.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. This number. Okay. We actually published another value using this other technique that we had developed with about 750 in 2007. The point I want to make here is that the numbers seem to be all over the place. So we really have to be careful about what are the techniques we're using, what exactly are we measuring, if we want to do absolute quantitation that are going to feed these models. And I see I'm running out of time or have run out of time. I just want to go very quickly just to look at some patient examples where I think modeling can help. Some interesting things that we're seeing here. This is a post-stent patient, hydrocephalus patient, and one of the things that you see here is within the cerebral aqueduct and within the fourth ventricle, there seems to be flow, there's pulsatile flow, but the flow seems to be in opposite directions in the center of the aqueduct as compared to the periphery of the aqueduct. What's going on there? Is that some effect of the shunt? That's somewhere where I think modeling can help out a lot. This is actually a patient that we saw not too long ago. This is actually not the patient had hydrocephalus as a result of cerebral palsy and a history of cerebral palsy and epilepsies, had a third ventriculostomy. You can see pretty much normal pulsations through the aqueduct, although I was going to say they're a little low, but they're kind of normal. They're typical of what you would see in the aqueduct. If I look in the pre-punching cistern, first of all, the first thing I notice is that the pulsations here are huge. You're getting what's called aliasing. Those of you who have been in the field will know that what that is, but basically you're getting many times over what you typically see in pre-punching cistern. Now, if you look here in the pre-punching cistern, I'm getting something which is, okay, it's a little phase advanced relative to the aqueduct, which is typical, but look at a different point within the pre-pumping cistern. The flow looks completely different. Look at this point, the flow is actually almost it's changed its phase, just moving over a little bit. So we're getting this very complicated system. Maybe it's related to the third ventriculostomy, maybe it's related to the hydrocephalus. You know, again, this is something where I think modeling can really play an important point. I'm going to finish up here. So what I think modeling can do for us is understanding the relationship between all these data that we can collect and symptoms and prognosis of the patients, predicting flows in various portions that we can't actually have access to, and predicting the effects of sensing and other devices. And I want to thank all my collaborators, and in particular Brain Child Foundation, who's funded our work. Thank you.